The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Most writers I know are always looking for their cave. I have a friend who actually bought a very small camper trailer to park in her driveway because she has cats and they drive her crazy. And so she somehow had to run away from her cats. And then there are other writers who, and I've done this, and for some reason it works. You can be in a crowded space that's very impersonal, like a cafe or on a train or ferry boat or something. And for some reason, you can isolate yourself and get some writing done in that way. And in fact, when I was, I just got back from a trip to the East Coast. And so I had a very long flight. And for some reason, I'm very grateful. I wrote like probably 4,500 words of my work in progress that I'm working on right now.
And welcome back to The Writer Files. I am your grateful host, Kelton Reed, wishing you pages, patience, and perseverance per usual. Number one New York Times bestselling author Susan Wiggs returned to chat with me about her island writing hideout, rescuing two puppies at the same time, holiday genre tropes, and her latest Christmas book, The 12 Dogs of Christmas. Susan is the award-winning number one New York Times bestselling author of over 50 published novels, with over 25 million copies in print, published in 30 countries, and translated into over 20 languages. Her latest, The 12 Dogs of Christmas, is described as the ultimate holiday gift from the bestselling author, a delightful novel about a Christmas transport of rescue puppies that's guaranteed to warm readers' hearts. Number one New York Times bestselling author Debbie McComber said of the book, "Don't miss this charming Christmas tale of thawing hearts, escaping dogs, and finding home." In this file, Susan and I discussed writing on planes, trains, and automobiles, her love of classic Christmas stories, how the latest ties into her Lakeshore Chronicles series, why one of the easiest things to do in the world is not write, getting snowed in with Toni Morrison, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates and other resources for writers. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us. Yes, we are back once again. I am honored today to be joined by a returning guest. We have, of course, number one New York Times bestselling author, Susan Wiggs, and I have been catching up, and it's been a minute, but yeah, I can't wait to talk about what you've been up to.
I love this chat with you, and I can't say enough about how enjoyable it is to sit with somebody who really gets it, gets the way a writer thinks and the way a book works. And so, yeah, feel free. I am yours to, my brain is yours to pick.
Perfect. Well, pick away we will. And I want to catch up about, of course, the release of your latest, The 12 Dogs of Christmas, which I've been enjoying very much. And yeah, we're going to talk all about that, of course, and what you have been up to over the last 6 months. I wanted to, you know, talk a little bit more about, you know, I'll just remind you what we talked about on our last show. We really got to dig into your process some. We were talking about, you know, how you became a professional writer, how you really kind of embody, you know, just this perseverance and the longevity of your career obviously points to that with over 50 books now You probably even lost count. Your name is now much bigger than your titles, and that's I think something we also touched on. But you seem also very humble, and of course you have this fantastic writer's retreat there. And are you in Puget Sound at the moment? Are you out there on Bainbridge Island?
I am. I'm in my Bainbridge Island home, which really, I love to write all over the world, you know, on trains and ferry boats and wherever I happen to be. But I have to say my most productive times are when I'm sort of cloistered in my writing space at my home.
Yeah. And I have to say, I have family that live in Seattle, a brother, in fact. And I have spent a good amount of time on Bainbridge, and it's just such a magical place. You know what I always enjoyed the most was just taking the ferry over, and that the kind of the quiet and the solitude of the sound. Of course, so much water, and then the mountains. Of course, you're just right there in the shadow of Mount Rainier, which is just this beautiful, picturesque scene, like daily, right?
Oh my gosh, it is. Yeah. And so if listeners are curious, they can find me on Instagram. I've almost always got a shot out my window, you know, rain or shine. There's always something to look at out there. Even, you know, it could be an aircraft carrier going by, or, you know, just Mount Rainier at sunrise. It's just really stunning. And so I feel really lucky. But on the other hand, writing happens so much inside your head that having a beautiful, gorgeous place to do it is not required. It's just kind of a bonus.
That's right. Yes. But a magical place it is. And it made me happy to watch that video you had on your website of talking about your writing retreat there in your office and the sound. And it's all really beautiful. But yeah, so we talked about how your writing process has changed over the last 36 years. And of course, you had mentioned, I thought was fun to revisit, that you're a lefty and that you do your first drafts always in longhand.
I do. And that's one of those habits that I think I'll probably take to the grave with me. I suppose it has to do with, and you would know more about this than I do, about the way your brain is connected to your hand and your nervous system and your thoughts and things like that, because it seems to be my initial way to express myself. And it's weird because once I have my manuscript rendered in type, I edit the heck out of it. And so, but it seems like the initial composition wants to be done in longhand.
Yeah. And I wonder if that doesn't point to something, again, you mentioned it, kind of that neurobiological piece of, you know, what they say, and we could also speak to kind of like the different styles of different generations of writers, because I'm sure that a lot of younger writers...
Oh, they write on their phone. They probably, you know, talk their books into their phone and while they're staring off into space. And I admire that so much, but I can't imagine trying to do it.
Yeah. Well, they, you know, I think that the studies have shown that, especially in like an academic setting, that taking notes by hand actually helps retention. And I wonder if it doesn't have to do something with your storytelling process of you kind of hashing out the story. Initially, it helps you to kind of like process, at least, you know, maybe even that empathy piece with your characters and these, you know, again, kind of getting into the style of writing that you do, which is, as you've mentioned, like ordinary people facing extraordinary circumstances, that you're kind of able to almost empathically kind of become these characters as you're writing them.
Yeah, that's true. And I think like most writers, I'm highly distractible. And so if I limit myself to, you know, a notebook and a pen, I'm less likely to look at a notification or, you know, wander away and go down a rabbit hole. And the internet is great for that. And I get lots of, you know, ideas for my book. But in the initial composition phase, I think it's more of a distraction for me, at least.
Yeah. Yep. And I've heard this so many times that so many prolific authors use this method where, you know, and even the ones who don't handwrite are using a dedicated word processing, you know, either a computer that's not connected to the internet or some other way to get the words down that, again, doesn't have that internet connection. Or, you know, they're using some kind of an app that actually blocks the internet from, you know, whatever that time period is.
Most writers I know are always looking for their cave. I have a friend who actually bought a very small camper trailer to park in her driveway because she has cats and they drive her crazy. And so she somehow had to run away from her cats. And then there are other writers who, and I've done this, and for some reason it works. You can be in a crowded space that's very impersonal, like a cafe or on a train or ferry boat or something. And for some reason, you can isolate yourself and get some writing done in that way. And in fact, I just got back from a trip to the East Coast. And so I had a very long flight. And for some reason, I'm very grateful. I wrote like probably 4,500 words of my work in progress that I'm working on right now. And totally missed the movie I thought I was going to watch. But yeah, for some reason, sometimes these other spaces where we're out in public, but we're still isolated, seem to work sometimes as well.
Yeah, amazing. And I'm recalling author Mark Dawson, who's had some very prolific success as a self-published author and now hybrid author, but really said that he found his most prolific time was on his commute to and from the city. He lives in Great Britain, but he was on the train, and that was how he was getting, you know, he said he wrote the equivalent of like the Harry Potter series in one whole year, just all on the train, just riding back and forth.
Wow, that's good. I have endless fascination for the way other writers work, because I'm always convinced that somebody has, you know, the easy way, but I never seem to find it, do I?
Amazing. Well, we got a chance to kind of explore your process previously, and that was great. I'll point to the first part of our conversation. So now we can kind of expand on that and talk a little bit more just about what you've been up to. Of course, when last we spoke, we were talking about Welcome to Beach Town, and obviously congrats on the success of that one. And now we're talking about The 12 Dogs of Christmas.
So I went from the beach to the snowy mountains of upstate New York in a nanosecond. And I normally, in the past, I've been more prolific, you know, usually out of necessity. But now I kind of have the leisure to take my time with books. But this year was kind of a strange year for me, because my publisher wanted a Christmas book, and they specifically wanted, and I usually don't write to prescription unless something inspires me, but they specifically wanted a Christmas book with a dog on the cover. And the reason is that they had watched the trajectory of sales on another author's Christmas book in some other year, a previous year. And it had a dog on the cover. I don't know, a dog on the doorstep or something like that. And it just sold like hotcakes. So they said, could you write a Christmas book with a dog on the cover? And I had just recently adopted these two little rescue dogs. And one of them came on a pet transport all the way from Texas.
Oh, wow.
To the Seattle area where I live. And so I said, well, how about we put 12 dogs on the cover? And indeed, they did. I assume you've got a copy of the book there.
I love that cover so much.
They got all the dogs on the cover. They had to wrap it around to the back. But I have to say, of all the books I've ever written, this is the cutest.
100%. I love these dogs. And, you know, I mean, who doesn't love a puppy in a Santa hat? So I think you've got a winner on your hands. Of course, this book, talk a little bit about, obviously, it is about rescue dogs and it is about relationships, obviously, but talk about how this kind of fits into your oeuvre. Am I saying that?
Yeah.
How it kind of fits in, because as I'm reading it, I'm like, oh yeah, this is the season I know, not some great departure. You haven't sold out for Christmas, so to speak. But yeah, talk about the inspiration behind this, because it is a compelling concept, and you know, and so many people, myself included, have like sometimes mixed feelings about holidays, you know, but yeah, talk a little bit about the inspiration behind it.
Right. Well, as soon as I kind of came up with the dog concept, the other thing is that a Christmas book, it's shorter, it's more of a merchandise item. You know, it's something you can find it in the bookstore, but it's also, you know, it's got a smaller trim size, lower cover price. It's that kind of impulse buy that, you know, the booksellers like to offer around the holidays. And so it needs to have a certain kind of holiday vibe and energy. It's not going to be laden with deep-seated, you know, traumatic issues, but there does need to be some substance to it to kind of grab the reader, the mature reader. So it's not just a children's book. And so in this one, what inspired me, first of all, I named the main character Brenda after the foster mom of one of the dogs that I adopted, Brenda in Texas. We've never met. We met on a Zoom call because she was fostering this litter of tiny puppies that had been created by a backyard breeder. You know what those are. They think they're going to breed dogs and then sell them in pet shops. I think in Texas, pet shops are still legal. And it never works out. You know, they end up surrendering the unhoused puppies to the shelters. And so anyway, she was just so compassionate and had such a can-do attitude. You know, somebody foisted 12 dogs on her and she's like, okay, I'll just expand my TV room here and, you know, put a baby fence up and hope for the best. So I was really inspired by her compassion and attitude and kind of a she was kind of a no-nonsense gal. And so Brenda in my book, another trope that is really common in Christmas stories, and it's the one that I love, is there's always a difference in energy between the Scrooge character and the happy-go-lucky, we love Christmas character. And so I was able to create that tension between Brenda. She's Scrooge. She's been screwed by Christmas when she was a kid. A horrible thing happened that she blames herself for. And so she's always had that kind of in her background. And then the book actually opens, and this isn't really a spoiler because it's the prologue. The book opens with her rushing her beloved little rescue dog, Tiny Tim, to the vet. And by a very dramatic turn of events, she discovers that her husband of several years has actually been cheating. And so once again, Christmas implodes for her. She's just devastated. And so that dynamic just kind of made it inherently dramatic. She hates Christmas, and so she wants to escape. And so her escape route for Christmas is, oh, I'm going to help my friend here pile these 12 dogs in a van and drive them from Texas up to the snowy woods of northern New York. So, yeah, I was inspired by a real world situation with rescue dogs. And I was also inspired by my love of a classic Christmas story. And when I see a classic Christmas story, it's either gift of the Magi, you know, somebody has to sacrifice something for somebody else. And then they have an equal and opposite sacrifice that kind of has irony and it's sweet, or it's Scrooge. You know, Scrooge versus the world. So for the 12 dogs of Christmas, I chose Scrooge versus the world. And poor Brenda, she thinks that she's going to escape Christmas. And she ends up in a town that is all about Christmas. And, they, you know, it's one of those towns, and you probably have them near you. Some towns, they put everything forward at Christmas to the point where tourists actually come to do photo shoots and look at the lights and, you know, do their shopping. And so she has no idea what she's in for. And so there's that.
So I'm actually from Denver, Colorado. And of course, there in the foothills or, you know, in the mountains, there is that very town. And it's actually, I think it's just become, it's called Santa's Workshop or similar.
Oh my God. Okay. I can totally picture it. People go to the lights and yeah, you take your kids there.
That's right. That's right. We used to take a train ride that was, had a similar theme. You get on the train, they serve you hot cocoa and hot toddies or whatever. You can sit there and eat your popcorn and look at the lights along this historic train route that kind of just winds through the mountains.
Love there. That. It's a treat. And I'm kind of a sucker for it. But of course, Brenda in the book just wanted nothing to do with it. She was hoping she'd, you know, spend Christmas on the road, you know, at a truck stop somewhere. But she ends up, obviously, the other trope that's common, especially in books that take place in the dead of winter, are, you know, the snowed in factor. Somebody has an accident or, you know, the road is closed or there's an avalanche, you know, some sort of contrivance that forces her to step back and say, well, I can't go home yet. And, you know, home doesn't really mean much to her anymore. So she's kind of one of those characters who's, she's really hopeful, but she's kind of sad. She, you know, her marriage failed a couple of years ago and she hasn't found her way to move on. And so she very unexpectedly finds it in this tiny town in upstate New York, which I've used the town of Avalon in many of my books. I wrote a series years ago called The Lakeshore Chronicles, and they're kind of reader favorites. They all revolve around this cute little town in the Catskills. There's a summer camp and, you know, it's beautiful in winter. And so I decided as just kind of an Easter egg for my readers of those books to set this book there. And the love interest, Adam, he's a character from those older books. He's all grown up now and he's a single dad and a paramedic and he's hot, of course, because it's a Susan Wiggs book after all. And yeah. So, and I love the kind of, the other thing that is fun about a book that takes place in the winter is there's a forced proximity that you can, you know, confront your characters with. They have to be together because either they're snowed in or, you know, she, in this case, she's staying with the patron of this rescue organization who happens to be Adam's mother, you know, so there's lots of fun ways to create romantic tension between the characters.
Yeah. Well, congrats, of course. I just was going to read, oh, I thought it was cool that Debbie McComber, another number one New York Times bestselling author, had called it a charming Christmas tale of thawing hearts, escaping dogs, and finding home. But yeah, congrats on the latest. Obviously, that is available now. I'm sure that we will see it as we are shopping for holiday gifts at our local bookstores. And yeah, I thought one interesting quote by you just kind of about your love of the writing career and this choice that you made to pursue this career is that just that it's more, it's as much a calling as it is a job for you. Do you want to just expand on that a little bit? Because I thought that was, I don't know, it was just kind of a moving statement.
Oh, well, thank you. I think one of the easiest things in the world is to not write. It's sort of like not going to the gym. You know that you should, you know that you're going to be happier with yourself if you do it, but it's super easy to not do it. You know, I've got a stack of delicious books on my nightstand. I'd much rather be reading them. But on the other hand, I think writers, especially long-term prolific writers, feel this urge that there's a story inside them that you just need to express, like breathing. And so I, you know, once I kind of get over my reluctance, there's some sort of beauty in the expression of that. And I'm not saying that all my books are beautiful and perfect, but they are expressions of my art, my emotions, my voice. And I I'm very compelled by that. And so I wish I could be compelled more on a schedule. That would be convenient. But sadly, I'm not. And I do my best to try to, you know, stay on track in that way. But just in general, it's one of these things that it's, I suppose I would call it a passion. I mean, I'm not like chomping at the bit or anything, but I just always feel compelled to tell a story. And I always have. I'm one of those who, you know, was sort of a writer and storyteller from a very young age. But I do meet people who want to write later in life or when they're students or when they're retired. And so I love that you can come to writing at any phase of your life, whenever, you know, whenever something calls to you or something happens or triggers you to want to get your story out.
Yeah, I love that about writing too, is that you'll have it at all phases of your life and for different reasons.
I do. And it's interesting. I'm a grandmother now, and I have two lovely little grandkids, and the 9-year-old Clara she's kind of fascinated by the process now, because she's just discovering, you know, longer novels and expressing herself. And, you know, she carries around a notebook like Harriet the Spy. Remember Harriet the Spy was one of my favorite books, and it's still an awesome book for kids. And so it's kind of fun to see that I'm modeling that. And I was actually looking for your podcast, and I came across a podcast with a writer named Catherine Howe, and she writes historical novels, but she also is the co-writer for Anderson Cooper. He wrote a book about the Vanderbilts, and he wrote his new book is about the Astors, and she's his co-writer. And she happened to be one of my fifth grade students back in the 1980s, 1988 or something. And she was my student. And I remember I was writing and teaching at the same time. I was new to it, you know, but I feel like I love seeing, you know, writers emerge from all kinds of places. It's really nice.
Yeah, really cool. What a cool story to find that podcast by an ex-student of yours, who obviously is thriving.
Yes.
And working with some talented people. I want to ask you a couple fun ones before we wrap up here. And obviously, it is always a joy to rap with you. But if you had to be stranded in a Catskill, snowed in the Catskills with any author from any era for a whole week, who would you choose?
Oh my gosh. Let me see. Probably Toni Morrison. And I'll tell you why. My mom's favorite book of her life, besides mine, she was required to have mine be her favorites, but my mom's favorite book was The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. And I just find her incredibly fascinating. And so I would love to spend some time with her. I believe she was a teacher. She's been a writing teacher. I don't know. I would just love to sit down with her and, you know, kind of discuss the craft and her process. And I almost said Stephen King, but he's too scary.
I can't imagine being snowed in with Stephen King and wondering like if something weird was going to happen.
Right. But no, I don't know, the way that Toni Morrison's books affect me. They're not like my books, but the level of her craft is just incredible to me. And so I feel like there would be a lot to learn, and there would probably be a lot to talk about.
For sure. So forced proximity with Toni Morrison, of course, and hopefully some of that would. Yeah, you'd have some kind of osmosis there between the two of you, chatting and catching up and talking about the careers and whatnot. But yes, okay, so Toni Morrison. Before we wrap, I wanted to ask one final question. How many dogs do you have now?
I now have two. I have Daisy Bellamy, and she's named after a book of mine, Marrying Daisy Bellamy. And Doug, spelled D-U-G, Doug Gunderson. That's my married name. And the two of them, you would think it would be a slam dunk that anybody could rescue a dog, but the rescue organizations are pretty picky. And so, for example, we have a pool, and there were some rescue organizations that didn't like people to adopt a dog if they had a pool because it's dangerous. You know, there were various factors, and so you have to apply and fill out an application, and it's kind of like, you know, adopting. They're pretty serious, and I understand why. It's because they don't want adoptions to fail and for the dog to end up back with them or with another rescue. And so they want it to be a permanent home for the dog. And so they're pretty picky. And there were a couple that didn't work out that we applied for. And you can tell them you want a small dog, you want a puppy, you want, you know, Chihuahua mix, or, you know, you can say your criteria. And so we filled out all the criteria, and two approvals came through kind of in the same week. And we were really only looking for one dog, but two puppies became available, and we couldn't make up our minds. So we said, you know, what the heck? We're going to get them both. And it actually turned out to be a good move for these two dogs because they're best friends. They look like they're in the same litter, Daisy and Doug. And so, yeah, again, your listeners should definitely go to my Instagram because there are lots of pictures of Daisy and Doug there, and they're crazy cute. So
love it.
Two at this time. And that probably will be a habit I get into. Always have two dogs at once.
Well, the 12 Dogs of Christmas, of course, a holiday gift worth giving, a warm cup of cocoa on a cold winter's day, and a charming story. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this and coming back and wrapping up our chat from before. And of course, it's always a pleasure to hang out.
Oh, same here. I've really enjoyed our chat, and I hope you guys have a good Christmas this year and every year.
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.